There is no Negro problem. There is no Southern problem. There is no Northern problem. There is only an American problem.
My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over.
Tonight I come before you to announce that the federal deficit, once so incomprehensibly large that it had 11 zeros, will be simply zero.
The nation has awakened to a sense of neglected ideals and neglected duties, to a consciousness that the rank and file of her people find life very hard to sustain.
So tonight, to you, the great silent majority of my fellow Americans, I ask for your support.
And I realize more than ever that as president, I need your help.
December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
I want a kinder and gentler nation.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. Happy President's Day to you. On this President's Day, we have two presidential scholars who will talk about who's been the most effective leaders of our country, who the greats are, who the near greats are, who the probably shouldn't have been presidents are. We have two guests with us. Mary Stuckey is a professor of communication and political science and graduate director in the Department of Communication at Georgia State University, author of several books, including Defining Americans, The Presidency and National Identity, and also Jimmy Carter, Human Rights and the National Agenda. And we thank you very much, Mary, for being with us. Hello.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Happy President's Day. Are you going to celebrate? Well, you're celebrating by being with us, but
I was going to say that is my celebration. I get
good
to talk about presidents.
Good, good. I'm glad. My mother is the only person I know, and I wish I had this, who used to celebrate George Washington. She celebrated everybody's birthday, but every president she liked would have their own separate set of decorations. So George Washington had his own box, and she'd bring them out every day, every February 22nd, and Abraham Lincoln had his day, and it was great fun. And then we'd read about them, and that's the way to go, I think.
That's very cool. My sister was born on Lincoln's birthday, and she never had to go to school on her birthday, which I was always jealous of.
That's a great story. Also joining us is Sean Wilentz, Sidney and Ruth Lapidus professor in the Department of History at Princeton University, author of The Age of Reagan, A History, 1974 to 2008, and The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln. Professor Wilentz, thank you very much for being with us.
Kathleen, it's a delight.
Yeah, delight to have you here. Are you having a party today, too, or is this your celebration?
Although I liked it better when we had different days for different presidents, lumping them all together. I mean, it's okay, but I liked the cherry pie on
Washington's
birthday, right?
Yeah. Well, there's no reason you can't do that.
I guess we can do them all at the same time, but then I get a little fat.
I know. That's my dog's birthday, though, too, so that's the only day he gets his own cheeseburger, although we may have to change and celebrate Washington's birthday as well. I love talking about the presidents because it marks time in history, too. It's a good way for us to learn history, I think, to remember what they were associated with, and I'm delighted to have both of you here. I need to start with the obvious question because it will spring a lot of phone calls and discussion, and our number, by the way, is 800-486-8655. And if you want to send an email, it's talk@wpr.org. When I look at by far and away the best president in this country, it's my own opinion, but it's got to be Abraham Lincoln because of what he came into and because of his incredible mind and powers of persuasion. Would either of you disagree with me on that?
Not me.
Not me.
Hey, really? Wow. Okay. He's number one. Why do you say that, Mary?
He transformed the nation. If you look at a speech that was poorly regarded in its own time, such as the Gettysburg Address, and the way that he moves the idea of a war fought to preserve the Union to one that is dedicated to a higher purpose, is remarkable. And the way he moves from a sort of Old Testament understanding to a New Testament in the second inaugural is there's no speeches, no two speeches that are more of a grace note of American politics than those two.
Woo, that's quite a way to put it. Moves from the Old Testament to the New Testament, and his words do have biblical proportions to them. I agree. They're just to be remembered forever. They're so moving.
I would agree with that. I would take it another level, another step, though, even, which is to say that while Abraham Lincoln was an extraordinary leader, faced with extraordinary problems like the nation falling apart.
Right.
And with slavery always there from the beginning, slavery was there as the problem that everybody knew was at the center of all of it. He was also an extremely skillful politician and government leader. You know, he was beset by problems that had far and beyond the Confederacy. I mean, he had factions in his own government. He had all kinds of things to deal with. And he had a lot of opposition. Indeed, he thought very late in the game that he would not even be reelected in 1864. Yet, through both combinations of good fortune on the battlefield and his own political abilities, which I think were above and beyond almost any other president I can think of, he managed to get it done.
And maybe I make too much of this, Mary and Sean, but I am absolutely flabbergasted when I look at people, and there are modern presidents who are like this too, but it's hard to think of anybody like Lincoln who came from absolutely nothing, who taught himself the law, who sat and read books in Old Salem, Illinois. It's just a story that dumbfounds me every time I hear it. How could anybody do that and become president?
Mary, you want to take that one?
I was going to hoping to fob that one off on you.
You're both going to get it.
I'll take it for a second just to say that while Lincoln's story is extraordinary, I mean, this was a phase in American history from, you know, roughly the 1820s on into later in the 19th century where political leaders at the very top actually did have stories of rising in ways that we could not imagine today. I mean, Lincoln came from just about nothing. Andrew Jackson came from absolutely nothing. Miller Fillmore, a president not often mentioned in these shows, also came.
No,
but he came from almost nothing. I mean, this was not as unlikely as opposed to our day, where one needs all sorts of credentials and schooling and so forth. Then I think, in some ways, not every way, but in some ways, things are actually more open.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
It's also true. Tell me how important this is. We were listening to a montage of some of the presidents when we start this show, and some of those speeches never fail to give me chills. They move me. They still move me because I associate them, the modern ones, with family and with times in American history and what happened to some of those presidents. But I'm wondering about this power of the word, because Lincoln was a master of it, perhaps above all, as far as I'm concerned, a master of it. How important that power of the word is, and who was able to craft that in a way that the American people would be moved to action or would be consoled or would be, you know, we would have this wise father figure.
You know, there's a debate in presidential studies and political science about whether presidential speeches matter or not. And there are people who will take a public opinion poll, and then there'll be a speech, and then they take another poll, and they'll go, wow, public opinion didn't move, so presidential rhetoric doesn't matter. I'm one of the people who thinks that's useful in some ways, but not necessarily the best way to understand the power of political rhetoric, because it is the presidency and the president who are best positioned to define us as a people. And when that definition resonates with the public and we accept it, that has effects that reach well beyond what can be tapped into by a brief public opinion poll.
I would agree with that, too. I mean, I think that there's a tendency sometimes to overestimate political rhetoric, but there's a great tendency to underestimate it as well. One thing I would add, though, is that one has to be careful to distinguish between great presidential rhetoric that historians look back on or we look back on and get chilled by, and what the effect was at the time, because sometimes they're very, very different.
Absolutely.
I mean, Mary, for example, mentioned the Gettysburg Address, which is an iconic text in American history. But at the time, you know, what did it manage to actually get done? It dedicated a cemetery. There were lots of people who thought that Edward Everett's interminable and boring speech of the same day was the major speech of the day. There were those who thought it was a great speech, not to say that there weren't, but it wasn't regarded as, at the time, as a sudden, you know, revelation in a way that we might find puzzling going back and reading today. So there is a distinction between the two, which we have to bear in mind.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really an important point, and it's also true that speeches that were considered extraordinarily important at their time don't have the longevity.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, how many of us can quote much from Webster or Clay?
Right.
In the way that we can all quote from certain timeless pieces of rhetoric.
Yeah. Let's talk for a moment, because you brought him up, or I certainly would not have thought about him, not that he's in the great category, but it's easy. It's amazing to me how we can just forget some people, and I guess one of them would be Millard Fillmore. I have a book in front of me with an attractive Millard Fillmore, widely considered one of the handsomest men of the era, is what this book says about him. But we don't remember Millard Fillmore, even though he was president at an important time in American history. Why don't we remember him, Sean?
Well, Fillmore, first of all, came to the office by accident. He was one of the accidental presidents because Zachary Taylor died, his predecessor. So he never had a popular mandate to begin with. By the way, he was actually pretty good-looking, and he was succeeded by the man who was probably the handsomest president ever, Franklin Pierce, and he was a much worse president than Fillmore was. So good looks may not go along with great presidential performance. Why is Fillmore forgotten? Fillmore is one of the two presidents who ran for the presidency when he finally did run and actually lost. That's an answer to a great trivia question, the other being Gerald Ford. But Fillmore, you know, was thrown into the middle of a great crisis, or a growing crisis of the nation, in 1850. And while he managed to get through the compromise of 1850, it was a truce that was not to last. And when he set about enforcing those aspects of the compromise that were particularly odious to the North, that is to say, the Fugitive Slave Act, he was kind of doomed politically. He did run for president again in 1856 on the Native American Party, for which he is probably best completely forgotten. So he was a man who was, shall we say, did not rise to the crises of his times.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think there's an important thing there, because I think that people who speak to great issues in important and significant ways and can speak to values and principles are more likely to give us rhetoric that transcends its time. And Fillmore spoke to small causes. You know, he was trying to defend the indefensible, and that's not going to give you soaring rhetoric,
mm-hmm.
generally speaking.
George Washington, usually considered number two among historians, probably both of you have been surveyed by Schlesinger in the past, or people who have done these. Would you put Washington as number two, and why does he rank among the top three usually?
Washington is up there for a lot of reasons. I mean, one is certain presidents like Washington get the glow of their entire career kind of placed on their presidency as well. So that, you know, Washington was the general who won the American Revolution. And, you know, you cannot keep that out of your mind when you're thinking about him. But his presidency, you know, was important because it put flesh on the Constitution of the United States. The Constitution of the United States made certain rules. It was like a blueprint for government. But it required a great deal of assembly. And Washington oversaw that as president of the United States with the advice of Alexander Hamilton, who became his closest confidant, really. Inside the cabinet, he pushed for an energetic executive, one which was a model for many later presidents. But I think above all, he oversaw the creation, really, of the American government, of the federal government, out of what the framers had done in Philadelphia.
Yeah, I don't think his rhetoric is all that spectacularly memorable, although certainly the farewell address is an important speech. But I've always kind of liked Washington for the things he wouldn't do. You know, he showed sort of remarkable restraint. They would have elected him president again, and he said no. You know, he refused to pray in public because he thought that his actions would influence other people so that they would feel as if they needed to do that. And he thought that that was inconsistent with the principles of small r Republican government.
Oh, my. Hmm.
And, you know, so he showed the sort of remarkable restraint as well as taking important action to give us an energetic government. And I kind of like that about him as well.
President's Day today is Happy President's Day. We are talking about the presidency this hour and trying to, well, we can't talk about all of them. There are too many, but we're looking at the most important presidents. Both our guests agree that Abraham Lincoln was our most important president and George Washington would rank among the top three. We're asking your thoughts, answering the very same question. Our guests are Mary Stuckey, professor of communication and political science, graduate director in the Department of Communication at Georgia State University, author of Defining Americans, the Presidency and National Identity, and Jimmy Carter, Human Rights and the National Agenda. Sean Wilentz is also here, professor in the Department of History at Princeton University, author The Age of Reagan, A History, 1974 to 2008, and the Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have all kinds of people on the line, so let me not let a moment pass before we go to you. Steve from Wausau is our first caller. Hi, Steve.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
For having me.
Sure.
My opinion is that the role of the president is to be an individual leader, and as such, I think he should anticipate things in society that are important, plot a course, and set direction. And one of the curiosities I've noticed is that, for instance, like Kennedy's well-remembered for the space program, but another thing he did that we've lost sight of over time are the Presidential Physical Fitness Awards program that he started and was later dropped. But now, you know, the health and fitness and that kind of thing is coming back to haunt us as a very important item in our society today that we don't have, but that's something that he saw as important and would have been good for us to keep.
Amen. Here it is again with Michelle Obama's initiative. A simple thing. Let's start with you, Sean, on this. But for those of us who were alive during that time, it was important.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that presidents can do a lot of different kinds of things beyond, you know, signing laws that Congress passes, especially the modern presidents. The physical fitness is one, getting the Peace Corps going.
Peace Corps, yes.
In Kennedy's case. I mean, there are all kinds of ways in which presidents can help, as Steve said, anticipate or understand the needs of society, but also to push the country in a particular direction. To raise challenges, as with the space program itself. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear what the caller said, but picking
oh,
up...
Oh, really?
On,
I'm sorry.
Yeah, picking up on what Sean was saying, it's interesting how we increasingly expect presidents to do something with every aspect of American life. I mean, everything that happens, we look to the president to speak, and then we get kind of cranky when the federal government is too powerful. And I think there's an important and interesting contradiction there, that every time something happens, if a shuttle blows up, if an earthquake happens in Haiti, we expect the president and the presidency and the federal government as a whole to take some kind of action, but then we're constantly bemoaning the fact that the federal government is intruding in every aspect of our lives. And it puts the president in this very tricky position of having to speak on everything without speaking on everything too much.
We go next to Alan from West Milwaukee. Hello, Alan.
Well, thanks for taking my call. It's fun to talk about the presidents on this day. In terms of the myth-making of the presidencies, I just wanted to say that after reading a lot about Lincoln, I became aware that one of the reasons he was able to be a politician was his father-in-law, Mary Todd's father, gave them a 120-acre farm in central Illinois, which supported them for the rest of their lives. So he had this—he wasn't this poverty-stricken guy. I mean, maybe he was, but his wife's family certainly wasn't, and that's how he had the time to be a politician. Secondly, he was an attorney for the railroads, which would be the equivalent of being a lawyer for Apple or something today. and he made incredible wealth, you know, very early. And then the third thing is that, you know, when he freed the slaves, he actually didn't do it to free the slaves. He did it to cripple the plantations by taking away their labor support. I mean, he was not an advocate of abolition himself.
Well, I think he became one. He was always against slavery. Well, those were his later years, and certainly, but he started with nothing. But go ahead. Who wants to respond? Did you hear that okay, Mary?
No, I can't.
Huh. I don't know what the heck the problem is. This was, well, we'll let Sean respond, and then you'll know what the caller said.
Okay.
It has to do with both how Lincoln made it rich and then the question of abolition and slavery. I mean, he married into a Mary Todd was not poor, and her family was well-to-do, but, you know, relatively well-to-do. But Lincoln really made his money, as you said later on, as a lawyer, particularly after he was defeated, he was not renominated for Congress after his one term in Congress. He went back to Springfield and more or less dedicated himself, thinking himself a failure yet again, to being as successful a lawyer as he could be. And he and his partner, William Herndon, did indeed become, you know, two of the most successful lawyers in that part of the country. A railroad lawyer, yes, although he argued on both sides of cases. He argued for the railroads in some cases. He argued against the railroads in other cases. He was just out to be as big and as good a lawyer as he could be. And he made a lot of money that way. By his standards, a lot of money. Today we would call him not wealthy, but certainly affluent. And if you ever see a picture of his house in Springfield, or if you go over there, I mean, it's really quite an impressive place.
Yes,
for a guy of his, you know, attainments, or a guy of his background, rather. As for the slavery business, I mean, he said once that he hated slavery as much as Frederick Douglass ever did. The question was how you go about addressing the problem. And he took the view that the Constitution of the United States barred any action by the federal government or by Congress to do anything about slavery where the institution already existed. And to do anything like that, as some of the abolitionists argued, would be, you know, might end slavery, but it also end the Constitution, thereby defeating the very purpose of being the President of the United States, which is to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So he went about things in a somewhat different way. But he was pledged, even before secession, he was pledged to a platform which would have tried to bottle up slavery to prevent its extension, which had been allowed under the Kansas-Nebraska Act and then under Dred Scott. He was pledged to end that policy and to halt slavery's expansion, which was then thought to be a kind of gradual death sentence for the institution. That was enough to lead the South to secede. So I think that from the start, Lincoln's hostility to slavery was there. Again, this goes to his political will. He also knew that a lot of Northerners wouldn't go along with immediate emancipation. So through a very long process, but one that I think is, looking back on it, quite politically skillful, he pushed the issue to the point where, by the end of his presidency, he was actually pushing for the 13th Amendment, which, you know, finally ended slavery altogether.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Rich from Baldwin. Hi, Rich.
Hi, Sullivan. I told you, Rich from Sullivan.
Hey, Rich. How are you? Let me first ask Mary. Can you hear him?
Only a very. I mean, just. Almost, I can hear him, but I can't quite get his word.
Okay, we'll pass along what he says, the crux of it. Hi, Rich, go ahead. Happy President's Day.
I want to put in a good word, ironically, for Lyndon Baines Johnson and James Earl Carter. I think we've talked about ending slavery, and I think Lyndon Baines Johnson finally came to the realization. He knew Congress inside and out. And he could get things done. And he basically said, America is going to be a nation where everybody has civil rights. He spoke of ending poverty in America. And while that was his ideal and it wasn't successful, at least he spoke of doing it and worked to do it. James Earl Carter also, on the domestic front, I think, is much maligned. I was really disgusted by Ted Koppel's America Held Hostage on the basis of the Iranian hostage, the American hostages in Iran. But James Earl Carter basically said, America, you're suffering from a delusion, and much of it has to do with energy sources. And we have to free ourselves from sources of foreign energy and become energy independent. A lot of people think Carter was not successful, but in terms of what Steve Romwasa said, presidents are supposed to anticipate the future. Lyndon Baines Johnson anticipated the presidency of Barack Obama. James Earl Carter predicted the dilemma that we now find ourselves in, that is way too dependent on foreign energy.
Yeah, perceptive comments. Thanks, Rich, very much. Take on LBJ and James Earl Carter, if you would, please. Mary.
Interesting way that he phrased that, because it really does go to the question of how we define presidential success. You know, had Lincoln not presided over the victory of the Union, would we still consider his rhetoric timeless, you know, had the Union lost the war? Certainly the speech after Selma, you know, where Lyndon Johnson says that civil rights is not a black problem but an American problem, and, you know, places the presidency in the center of civil rights movement and places civil rights in the center of American democracy. That's an extraordinary moment in our history. And that is a speech that continues to live. You know, part of Carter's problem in the energy speech is that it was, you know, frankly, just a really bad speech. And good ideas aren't going to be persuasive if they're framed poorly. And so it's a really interesting question, I think, how we define success.
I would agree with that, and look at politics as well. I mean, as the caller said, Lyndon Johnson, who had been master of the Senate, as Bob Carroll called him, you knew how to get things through. Even though he had a Democratic majority, a lot of those Democrats were Southern Dixiecrats. But he managed to get the Civil Rights Bill through, not simply by the strength of his rhetoric, which I agree with Mary, that's one of the great speeches in American history, as far as I'm concerned, the post-Selma speech, where he says, "We shall overcome," on top of everything else.
Yes.
But, you know, but behind the scenes, he was pushing, he had pushed the Civil Rights Bill through, and he was mounting an all-out offensive out of the White House to get Congress to pass the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Jimmy Carter, by contrast, didn't have that kind of deft political touch, shall we say. It goes to something about outsiders coming in, people who campaign as being outside of Washington, which is fine, except when you get to Washington, you have to govern in Washington.
Mm.
And from the start, Carter's presidency suffered because of difficulties he was having with what we'll call the Congressional Party, particularly Democrats on Capitol Hill, whom he irritated, who he made angry. He didn't come through with some of their early projects. He wasn't willing to play the game the way they wanted to play it, and that cost him. And by the time that energy speech was being given, his relations with the Congress were very poor. Many were supporting Edward Kennedy's effort to unseat him for the nomination by that time. And that speech had the effect, as prescient as it was and as far-seeing as it was, it kind of blamed the American people for their own problems, or certainly it was interpreted that way. And presidents have to lead as well as set a tone. They also have to be perceived as leaders. And I think in that case, Carter actually, although the speech was initially well-received, for being honest, nevertheless, Carter came across as being more, what should we say, hectoring than he did as a leader.
Mm-hmm. We need to talk about FDR. Many presidential scholars list him as in the top three. Mary, if you would please talk a little bit about when I think about him, the breadth of the government impact on American lives as a result of his presidency is quite extraordinary.
Yeah, I'm not even sure extraordinary covers it. I mean, if you realize that the size of the federal government, what it was before FDR and then afterwards, you know, extraordinary is a pretty small word. In addition, you know, he led people out of the Depression through a world war, surviving not just one but two major national crises. And, of course, no one was in office as long as he was. And so the depth and breadth and extent of his impact is immeasurable compared to other presidents.
Would you agree, Sean?
Oh, absolutely. And it's funny, I was just thinking that the three presidents we put at the top, Washington, Lincoln, and FDR, all were major participants in the three great revolutions in American life, which were the original American Revolution, the Civil War, which eventuated in slavery's ending, and then the New Deal and World War II, which had the great effect of modernizing both the federal government and American society, taking it out of the 19th century and into the 20th. So, yes, absolutely. He was also an extraordinary communicator. I mean, I think of the three we're talking about, I would even rate him higher than Lincoln, because in Lincoln's day, you know, presidents didn't have to speak as much. Presidents rarely gave speeches. When Lincoln spoke, it really mattered. Roosevelt, however, adapted to a wholly new set of media, particularly the medium of radio,
yes,
and became, you know, in the depths of the Depression, became the force through that power. And it wasn't always great speaking. It was just the way that he spoke and the way that he handled things. He gave people hope at a time when hope seemed to be completely vanished. So on all sorts of levels, rhetorical, political, even military, FDR is you know, unparalleled.
Yeah. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-486-8655. Mary, President Obama told ABC last week, I think, or the week before, that he'd rather be a really good one-term president than a mediocre two-term president, which begs the question, how many one-term presidents have been pretty good? Or more than that?
Not that many. you know, and, you know, I'd rather be right than president, right?
Right?
Well, he got to be right, and he didn't get to be president.
Right.
So, I think that what that means is that good presidents exert a certain amount of political courage, and sometimes they fail. You know, we were just talking about FDR. Well, this is a man who tried to, you know, was accused of packing the Supreme Court, who tried to purge Congress of people who disagreed with him, both of which were spectacular, catastrophic failures in many ways in the short term. And we forgive him those failures because of the other things he did. A year into Obama's presidency, it's hard to know not only what would be a failure, but what we will forgive him if other things work out for him.
Mm. Sean, your thoughts?
I mean, normally the rule of thumb is that one-term presidents fail because they fail to get reelected in one way or another. They fail to get the political job done, which is leading the country to the country's satisfaction. But secondly, that, you know, in the case of two-term presidents, the first term is usually pretty good and the second term is usually pretty lousy. Now, that isn't a universal rule, certainly not with Lincoln, for example, or with FDR. But you can see that pattern repeatedly. In the case of the Reagan administration, for example, a two-term president who was very, very popular at certain moments in his presidency, not in others, managed to have a fairly successful first term. He got everything he wanted to get through, pretty much. But then in the second term, he ran into Iran-Contra, and his popularity plummeted. And it was only his willingness to embrace, you know, Mikhail Gorbachev at the very end of his presidency that kind of saved it. But he had a pretty rocky second term. You see that U.S. Grant is another example, just out of history, the only two-term president between Jackson and Wilson, who actually served full two terms. Great first term, second term beset by scandal, beset by all sorts of accusations. So I think that if the incumbent wants to do well, he better plan on doing well now.
Let's spend. We had an email. I want you to talk a little bit more about Grant. Jay wants to know why Grant. How could somebody be such a great general but such a poor president?
Well, I'm actually of the. I'm of the revisionist school here. I may be alone in this, but I think that Grant's presidency has been maligned. I think that certainly, you know, in all sorts of ways. He certainly had the greatest civil rights record of any president between Lincoln and Lyndon Johnson. He crushed the Ku Klux Klan. Hmm. He fought very, very hard to maintain, within the limits of the Constitution, as he understood it, but to maintain the Reconstruction governments, to push hard against the white backlash that was occurring down there. He had the most far-sighted Indian policy of any president of the 19th century, as far as I can see. He actually had plans on education that were quite, if we had those education plans intact today, a lot of our craziness would be abated. We don't, but there we are. He didn't succeed in that, but at least he stood up for it. I also think that some of the scandals were vastly overblown, that when you look at them closely, not only was he not implicated in the way that that some accused him of being, but he actually, more often than not, did the right thing. Not always. He was flawed. But I actually think his presidency stands up pretty well, and if the book I'm writing now about him gets anywhere, he'll be even higher rated.
Send us the book, please.
I will.
Me interested in learning more about him. Was he much maligned? Do you agree, Mary?
I think that he was perhaps maligned. I don't know to what extent much maligned, but I'm going to defer to his expertise on Grant on this one.
Okay.
I do think that being a general and a president involve very different kinds of skill sets in very different kinds of political contexts. I do think that being a general isn't merely strategic or martial. I clearly leadership, persuasion, administrative ability all matter if someone is going to be an effective commander. And I think Eisenhower is a particularly good example in modern times of that. And I also think that it was clear that both Grant and Eisenhower were in many ways better at the administrative sides of their presidencies than perhaps at managing their images.
Hmm. More phone calls in a moment. On this President's Day, we're talking about the most effective and least effective American presidents. We have two presidential scholars with us, and we're welcoming calls for them. Our number is 800-486-8655. Sean Wilentz is author of The Age of Reagan, A History, 74 to 2008. Also, The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln. And as you heard him say, he's currently writing a book on Grant. Mary Stuckey, professor of communication, political science, graduate director in the Department of Communication at Georgia State University, author of Defining America, The Presidency and National Identity, and Jimmy Carter, Human Rights and the National Agenda. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, Jim Wallace will be joining us. Most of you are familiar with him. He's president and CEO of Sojourners. His latest book, Rediscovering Values on Wall Street, Main Street, and Your Street, A Moral Compass for the New Economy. We go back to phone calls. Frank from Madison. Hello, Frank.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Frank.
Happy President's Day.
And you as well.
May I make a quotation, it's quite a familiar one from Twelfth Night, which is that some people are born great and others have it thrust upon them, you know, which of course is a joke. There are presidents who were unlikely as great presidents who sort of had it thrust upon them. And there are more, but I would say that that includes Lincoln, who was an outsider and considered weak. Teddy Roosevelt, who was considered a nutcase and dangerous. Franklin, who was a third-rate man, famously with a first-rate temperament. And then finally, the mendacious Lyndon Johnson. And yet they all, at some point, perhaps were forced to grasp the situation, and they did. So that might be a useful idea or not. So thank you.
It always is. Your ideas are. Thanks, Frank. If you could center on Teddy Roosevelt, because we haven't really talked about him at all, why don't you start, Sean?
Well, Teddy Roosevelt was thought of as a cowboy. I mean, you know, he came to the vice presidency in the election of 1900, having made his way at the Battle of San Juan Hill. He was a kind of privileged little, well, they called the cowboy. And he came to the presidency after McKinley's assassination, so that, Frank's right, I mean, the presidency was very much thrust upon him. He would not have thought that greatness was thrust upon him. I think that Teddy Roosevelt thought that he had a destiny from very early on. He had a troubled childhood because of illness, asthma, and so he built himself up as a kind of, you know, muscular Christian hero, even though he had a voice that was very, very high and stuff like that. But sure, I mean, he became, in effect, I think, the first truly modern president, or at least beckoning the way to the modern presidency in terms of its actions in moving things forward. He was, I don't know, one could have seen Teddy Roosevelt doing something with his life. He had already done a fair amount by the time he became president. The one that strikes me, actually, I'm going to add another name into the hopper, and
please,
if you want, is Harry Truman.
Yes.
Who, you know, like what he did or not like what he did, he, you know, came to the presidency, you know, thought of as an absolute nothing, a kind of party man from Missouri, and ended up, you know, having to make some very difficult decisions, and ended up doing some very important things, which most presidents don't get the chance to do. So I would throw his name in the hopper as well.
Yeah. What do you think of Harry Truman? Mary?
I quite like Harry Truman. And again, in some ways, for some of the things he didn't do, and for the fact that, again, love him or hate him, and there are good reasons why people may object to some of the things he did, he always had the courage of his convictions, and he was always able to, this is what I did, and this is why.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, somebody who is capable of making those kinds of claims is always admirable. To say, you know, and one of the things I like most about Lyndon Johnson is that when it comes to his presidential library, his attitude was, if people understand what I was doing, they will judge me fairly. That's, you know, for somebody who studies the presidency, that attitude towards one's archive and the threats and the...
Okay. I'm sorry, that phone just went. We'll try and reconnect with you, Mary. Let me ask, just because we did a show, a lot of it was on Harry Truman and the Atomic Bomb with Gary Wills a couple days ago. I was thinking as I was reading that book that Harry Truman may have built substantially the military-industrial complex, the war thought of as Harry Truman's war, the Korea War, the concern about communism maybe not being as big a thing as he thought it was, in sort of the whole beginning of the witch hunt starting under his administration. Is that a significant negative, do you think, Sean?
Well, I think that, I mean, you don't want to blame a president for everything that occurs on his watch. The anti-communism stuff was coming out of all sorts of places, and there was actually, also a pressing problem. I do think that the way in which the United States had mobilized after, into World War II, you do see a significant drop thereafter. I mean, America did demobilize. The guys came home, the best years of their lives, that whole business. But, in effect, a new front had begun. And here, you know, Truman made some choices that, looking back on, I wish he hadn't made. But I think overall, he had less to do with the creation of the military-industrial complex than he did to sort of preside at a time when it arose. And it arose very much out of fortunes that were being made and connections that were being forged during World War II.
Let's go to Mike from Ironwood, Michigan. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Hi.
My comment is actually concerned President Obama.
Pardon? No, I hear you. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Concerned over Obama, I didn't vote for him. I didn't like the idea of a Chicago politician being in there running the country and what I heard. But nevertheless, our country is at stake in issues that come to play here. But we've seen his popularity plunge, and he is a wonderful speaker. But has he got the vision and apparently the willingness to put politics aside somewhat and deal with the benefits of the country? And that history will gradually rewrite that. But he made quite a bit to talk about cooperating with the Republicans and so forth on the other side. And apparently, certainly the health care and others, that hasn't happened. And I'm still trying. I listen to NBC, then I turn on C-SPAN. You kind of go back and forth and listen, and you can get two different approaches to it. But apparently this cooperation with the other side of the aisle has been not his strong point, and he made quite an issue of it.
Professor Willens.
Well, I mean, the first comment is that you can never put politics aside. I mean, no matter how much you might campaign against politics. The essence of governing is a different kind of politics. There's the politics of getting elected, and there's the politics of governing. And they're two different skill sets, as Mary would put it. And he's very able, obviously, at the first, and tremendously able at the first. The second, he is still, being tested. On the bipartisanship, I was always wondering why a leader from the Democratic Party was thinking that it would be easy enough to work with the Republicans because the Republican Party has changed so much. I say that not as a political statement, but just as an historian watching the evolution of the Republican Party, where it's become much more monolithic, much more monochrome, ideologically and even socially, than it had been. There's nobody in the House of Representatives from the Republican Party in New England, for example. That tells you a great deal about where the Republican Party has gone and the likelihood for there to be interchange. But by the same token, I think that the White House also bears some responsibility, not just for failing to get Republicans on board, but for the whole way that the issue was handled from the beginning. And that I take to be a measure of inexperience more than anything else. And I think and hope that the president can learn from that.
Your assessment, and I know it's only a year, but Professor Stuckey, of the Obama administration.
Such a tricky question, because I think it goes back to the question of how we define presidential success. Obama ran prominently on the idea of changing the culture in Washington, and so for him to go in and behave in a purely partisan way that will perhaps force through some of the policies would get him some things, right? It would get him the policies. It would allow him to claim victory. But if what he really wants to do is change the culture in Washington, that's a particularly tricky goal, because it depends on the behavior of people who have said they want to destroy his presidency.
Right.
And so that's, I don't know how you do that. If what he sincerely wants to do is change the culture in Washington, his rhetorical and political options are somewhat limited. He can't behave as George W. Bush did. But he has to get cooperation from people who have said they will never cooperate with him. And so I don't know what to do about that.
It is true. I can't remember a time in my life, which is getting pretty long now, when there were such expectations for a president, when we were, many of us, glued to our televisions because it was such an event in American history, and he lived up to it in his initial speeches.
He is remarkably eloquent, but eloquence doesn't solve political problems.
Yeah.
I would agree with that. I mean, it's and you don't get out of political problems by being eloquent either. A president can only do that so many times, but in the end, you have to be able to, as I say, undertake the politics of government, and the speeches that can, can be laid aside.
Well, you two have been just fabulous. What a way to celebrate President's Day. I feel good. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, thanks for having me.
A great pleasure. Our thanks to Sean Wilentz, professor in the Department of History at Princeton University, and to Mary Stuckey, who is at the Department of Communication at Georgia State University. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, Chrissy Peace for on-air production. We'll be with you again tomorrow.
Confidence and courage are the essentials of success in carrying out our plan.
We're here today to raise the flag of victory over the capital of our greatest adversary.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
So it is apparently necessary for me to state once again, not what kind of church I believe in, for that should be important only to me, but what kind of America I believe in.
And the people who knock these buildings down will hear all of us soon.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.